Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is February 16, 2019, and I'm talking with Donnie Larson from Gypsy. Donnie, let's start with that bus ride from St. Paul to Los Angeles. Do you recall who all went out on the bus with the Underbeats?
Well, I'm pretty sure it was the whole crew, Jim Johnson, Tom Nystrom, Enrico, Walsh, and I. And then I think the two roadies, Kenny and Patrick.
Well, what were the roadies' last names again?
I think it was Patrick Grimm and Kenny Enquist.
And Kenny was One Eye, right?
Yeah, Kenny was One Eye, and Patrick was Pokey, I guess they called him, I think.
So what do you recall about the bus ride out to California?
Well, I took the first shift, so I went back of the bus, woke up. These guys were just pulling into Albuquerque, New Mexico. They were going to get something to eat. And I had to be, I figured, okay, I'm in New Mexico. It's going to be hot, right? So I got up out of the bunk, and it was freezing cold, ice everywhere. Just took a step outside the door and went right on my ass, my butt. I slid on the ice. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. It was like below zero in Albuquerque, and they just had snow and ice storms.
And before that, were you in Colorado where you had the issue with the police?
No, that was in Flagstaff, Arizona. By then, Rico had to leave because his dad passed away and he came home. Yeah, we got confiscated. The bus got confiscated in Flagstaff with Walsh driving because it was school bus orange, and that was illegal in that state to have it that color. So they escorted us to the hardware store. And we painted the school bus red, white, and blue right there in front of the police station.
Great, yeah. Great story. So you get to Los Angeles. Where did the band first stay?
Steve Freeman had a house rented for us out in the valley, in the San Fernando Valley. And it was Johnson and Tom in one room, and me and the two roadies in the other room, and Rico and Walsh were staying with some friends in Hollywood.
Was that Sun Valley?
I can't remember. It probably was Sun Valley, San Fernando, but it was way out in the valley, yeah.
So what's your first impression of Los Angeles?
Driving down Sunset Strip. Golly, a bunch of bumpkins just fell off the back of a turnip truck. You know, driving a red, white, and blue school bus that we had painted Zodiac signs on it, and Johnson painted a picture of Mickey Mouse on the back door. You know, and it's just a flag for the cops to stop you, always.
So you got pulled over.
A bunch of hippies.
So you got pulled over quite a bit, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And it was not pleasant in some places.
Do you recall your first job as the Underbeats in Los Angeles?
I believe it was at Gazzari's, right down the street from Whiskey A Go-Go. For some reason, Steve Freeman had some connections there, and we got in there, and they really liked the harmony, because at that time, I mean, we had like four lead singers in the group.
Was Freeman already out there in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think he drove his Jag out there, and he had a cousin out there that he was staying. Steve Freeman stayed out there, too, in the house after a while. I mean, he had his own room, and we had, it was a crowded situation, but we didn't care. We were on a big adventure.
Was Steve managing the band at that time?
Yeah, Steve got us every job that we had until the band, just before I quit, when they went with Don Hunter from the Guess Who Bought Them. Freeman was responsible for every gig that we had out there.
What do you recall about playing at Gazzari's?
Oh, it was great. It was basically a teen club. I'm not sure what the thing, what the ad deal was, but it was all young people in there. Good stage and stuff, and we were having a good time. I remember Jim Johnson and I, we were smoking cigarettes at the time. We were hanging out the front door on break, and Rich Little walked by. And Johnson said, "Look, it's Little Richard." And Rich Little just cracked up.
Now, that was kind of like American Bandstand, right, where kids just danced and they filmed it and put it on.
Yeah, we were up on stage, and they sometimes had go-go girls around. But, we were the new celebrities in town. Well, it was obvious we were bumpkins. We were from Minnesota. We didn't dress or anything like those kids out there.
Oh, you weren't dressed in the latest hip styles?
Well, it was kind of like, at first it was lounge lizard act type stuff, you know, with the white belts and, you know, that kind of stuff, that just lounge lizard stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
until we came back the first time. Then after that, when we moved down to the whiskey, we just said, nah, that's it. We're hippies. We're dumping this stuff.
Now, I understand the Bill Gazzari and his wife came up with a new name for the band, and it was called the Groovy People. Is that right?
I never even heard about it because I rejected it completely. They wanted us to be a hip four freshmen, you know, and we just said, nah, that ain't going to cut it. And they offered us, we had an offer for He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, to do that song, too, and we said, nah, we didn't want that.
Who wanted you to do He Ain't Heavy?
Freeman, I think he had it, we had a chance to do it with, I don't know, one of the record labels out there. They wanted that, the song he wanted us to do it, and we rejected that offer completely. Tom Nystrom was still with us at that time.
This is before the Hollies version came out?
Yeah. We had a chance to do it before the Hollies.
Huh.
And they wanted, like I said, they all the record labels and stuff were wanted to drop kind of the rock stuff and be, you know, like a hip four freshman and stuff. And we just went nuts with that. Said no. And when we came back after Tom quit, we came back and Jay Epstein was living with those guys up at Silver Lake area in L.A. That's where the Manson family cut through their yard to get up to the, you know, well, that whole thing. And that's around that round table when they, I think the second or third day, we said, we got to do something about this name. And so I just popped in my head. I said, Gypsy. That's it. Boom. That's it. And that took care of that.
I understand it was, you said, we're living like gypsies, right?
Yeah, I said, Gypsy, we're living like gypsies.
Yeah.
It fit us, you know, with the new hippie ethic, you know, because Jay Epstein had hair down to his shoulders, and he was such a hippie dressing, you know, with the boots and all that stuff. So we said, well, that's why it fit. I said, Gypsy, and he said, yeah, we're living like gypsies.
Now, Tom Nystrom, was he in the band or out of the band when you went to the whiskey?
Well, he wasn't with us at that time. No, he left. We came home, I think it was in the spring, in April or May sometime.
Of 70 or 69?
69, I think. Yeah, we went out there in 68, Thanksgiving, day after Thanksgiving, and then we came back in the spring of 69 to regroup and do whatever, and that's when Tom left.
Tom didn't like the smog and the earthquakes, right?
Yeah, well, they'd had an earthquake when we were out there, and that scared the living daylights out of them.
So
didn't bother none of us, though, you know.
Yeah, well, so you came back. This is before you're at the whiskey, right? Why did you come back to Minnesota in the spring of 69?
Well, just to check in, get the wives. Johnson brought his wife back out. I brought my wife back out. It was a big confused mess.
And to look for a new drummer as well?
No, we had the drummer. I don't know how or where Epstein came to the group. But we all agreed that we needed a flashy drummer at the time. And Jay fit the bill. He was dual bass pedals like Ginger Baker and blah, blah, blah. He was really he's a jazz drummer now, you know. I mean, he's really an accomplished drummer. So we thought that's what we needed at the time.
So how long were you back in Minnesota in the spring of 69?
I think we were only back for a couple months. We went back out there. It was warm out. I had the wife and the kids in a U-Haul trailer, and it was warm out, going across the desert, really hot.
How would you describe the scene on the Sunset Strip?
Oh, it was nuts. We'd go, the dressing room was on the second floor, and they had these huge windows that opened up.
At the whiskey?
When we were doing the gypsy thing at the whiskey. And, I mean, anything you wanted was there on the street on the weekends. It was kind of deserted during the week, you know, just normal traffic and stuff. But from Friday night till Sunday, I mean, it was wall-to-wall people all the way down as far as you could see in the Sunset Strip. And then the Gov decided to call out the troops. And that's when they started knocking heads. And they'd have, on a regular basis, the cops would sweep down the Sunset Strip. And anybody that didn't get out of their way, they'd throw the cuffs on them, throw them on the ground. And there was a paddy wagons that came behind them. and threw them in there and arrested them.
So were you aware of the new songs Rico was writing at this time?
Yeah, we were all in on it. You know, like he'd come to us with a piece of a song, okay? You know, like some words and stuff that either he wrote them or I don't know where he got them from. But Walsh, I'll tell you right now, is a great musician as far as arranging songs and stuff. So between Rico writing the words and having somewhat of an idea, Walsh and Johnson would fine-tune everything with us. Tom was in on part of that when we were out there in the valley. Tom was in on some of those songs that we'd... We all wrote different parts for the songs. You know, I wrote different parts of the songs. I wrote all my bass parts. Well, writing them is kind of a stretch. We made them up as we went.
Were you practicing in the garage there?
It was a indoor patio kind of thing. It wasn't exactly a garage. It was like a, yeah, you could use it as a garage, but that's where we did it.
How long would you practice every day?
Oh, every day would be like, if we got something done, it'd be 3-4 hours. But that was nothing new when we were in the underbeats. We used to practice for 4 or 5 hours twice a week, every week.
What was your initial reaction when Enrico started writing less commercial-sounding songs and more progressive-type songs?
I was reluctant. Because what we were faking it, making it up as we went. That's how it worked back then. And we were rehearsed before we went into the studio, which a lot of bands, you know, didn't do. They would do it in the studio, create whatever they had, you know, the scraps of the songs. We couldn't afford to do that. And Metro Media loved it because we already had the songs pretty much arranged by the time we got to the studio. Then it was overdub stuff and everything back then.
Now, do you recall the very first night you played at the Whiskey?
No.
Okay.
No, it all ran into each other. Mm. To me, it wasn't that big of a deal because the Whiskey a Go Go to us were, well, that's where Johnny Rivers or something.
Johnny Rivers opened up that place.
Yeah, yeah. And we thought it was just another club. We were kind of ignorant of the fact that it was the hot spot to play in L.A., especially in Hollywood at the time.
What kind of crowd? What kind of crowd did you draw to the Whiskey?
It on the weekends. If we played there on the weekends, it was packed. You got all kinds of people. But when you played during the week, all the rock artists that were appearing around L.A. at that time on the weekends would come into the Whiskey to party. And so you never knew who was out front. Everybody from the guys in Led Zeppelin to, you know, the guys in Poco, and it was just potpourri of artists out in front.
What kind of bass guitar did you play at that time?
I was back playing Fenders.
Precision?
Fender Jazz bass.
Fender Jazz? What kind of amp did you use?
Oh, I had a great big acoustic 360, which was big enough to install as a, you could have used it as an outhouse. And it sounded, I was talked into playing it. I wanted my Fender stuff back that I created. Well, Lopez helped me do it, but I had created one of the best modified dual Showman bass amps ever, and it was gone, and I wanted it back. I was really upset about that acoustic.
It was gone? What do you mean? What happened to it?
I sold it to a guy in St. Paul, a keyboard player that used to do the Lee Michaels thing, where he'd play the pedals, and he played them through the bass amp. It was 215s and 212s with 110-watt dual Showman modified head, and he still got it as far as I know. He won't give it up.
Now, when you're at, when did you start recording at Devonshire? Was it still 69?
Yeah, I believe it was 69 or early 70. Yeah, somewhere. It all kind of got faded because things got pretty busy when I brought my wife and kids out there. We didn't have a place to stay, and we were sleeping on Steffi, Bill Lorden's girlfriend, I think it was at that time, at her apartment. Me and the wife and two kids were sleeping on the floor there.
Did the band house change? Did they move out of Sun Valley?
Yeah, yeah. Most of the guys moved up. Rico and Walsh and some of the crew and Jay Epstein, they lived at the house in Silver Lake.
Okay, and the house in Silver Lake was the one that backed up to the La Bianca house?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they had to have parked their cars down below. There was a parking lot down below where people used to go over to Griffith Park. So they had to come up the hill, cut through the backyard where those guys were living, to get up to the La Biancas. That's why the cops came through the next day and busted everybody.
Now, you opened up for some pretty big national bands at the Whiskey, correct?
Yeah, kind of fades, but yeah, we were doing some stuff. We did. John Mayall was one of them, and oh man, I can't remember.
Chicago?
I've got it all written down in a scrapbook somewhere. I think Denny's got it.
How about Chicago?
Yeah, well, Chicago was the last big band before we went into the Whiskey. And they came. They used to come down. Terry Katz used to hang out with Rico and them guys.
Right. So let's talk about Devonshire. What do you recall about the, well, let me ask this. How long were you in Devonshire to record the first double album?
Months.
Okay.
I'm getting a little bit fuzzy at my age, remembering a lot of that stuff. All I remember is we spent a lot of time in that studio, and I never got paid a dime for it.
Did you play your bass guitar directly into the board or not?
Yeah.
Into the board.
Yeah,
okay.
And I didn't like that at the time because I had very little control over what I could do. And it was pretty splintered. You know, at the time you'd do a piece here and a piece there, and they back up, okay, we don't like this section here, so we'll punch you in, and then we'll go and fix this section and stuff, and overdubs and overdubs and overdubs. It was pretty boring.
Now, the engineer was Glenn Pace, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you recall? Anything stick out about him when you think of him?
Not really. He was kind of just part of the thing. And, he did a lot of coaching and stuff about us because we were pretty ignorant when it came to recording in a high-tech studio, which it was at the time. But then he was a kind of an independent engineer. When I was overdubbing some tracks at some other place, he was the engineer there, too.
Was he a younger guy or older?
Oh, he was about our age, a little bit older than us. I think I was 26, and he was probably in his 30s.
Let's see. Did you go out and watch other bands play live at in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I went with my wife. We went and saw Aretha Franklin when she was in town, James Brown when he was in town. Most of the stuff that we did, we were so dead broke because I wasn't being paid a dime on anything. I was not getting a salary at the time. I didn't know it. Restricted it a lot to the bands that we were playing with at the Whiskey.
Right. Did Steve Freeman get the album deal with Metro Media?
Yeah.
Did you ever go to the offices of Metro Media?
Nope.
Never?
Nope.
Oh.
Artie Valando would come see us. And he was in the studio when we were recording. He was our main guy contact with Metro Media.
Valando. Arthur Valando. Yeah. And
Julia Alio was the actual A&R guy, the producer, with him and Glenn behind the console all the time.
When did you have the album all finished up and ready to press?
Oh, that's a good question.
Sometime.
You'd have to ask Johnson that, or Walsh might know.
Actually, I know. It was released in August of 70.
Okay.
Now
all
that
right.
I think
yeah,
about
that's
it.
About right. That's about right. I know they went over it and over and over. You know, back in those days, it was like you had to do 100 takes on one song to get it right. Now they're going more for the spontaneous feel and to edit it, you know.
Let's talk about the Atlanta Pop Festival in July 1970.
Yep.
Turns out to be one of the biggest festivals in American music history. What do you recall about that?
Well, I recall how hot it was.
Sure.
We came in, and it was just, we came in at night, and it was just brutally hot. We stayed at some motel. But when we got to the grounds, once you got in, there's no leaving. You know, I mean, it was that crowded. B.B. King was there at that one, too, and it was in his book that he wrote about it. Someone spiked the water tower with MDA. So everybody was just flying. And
what is that? What is MDA?
Multiple drug assortment is what I got out of it. And we got the Allman Brothers were on just before us, I believe. And we got up there, and it was so hot, and we just went for it. The crowd wouldn't let us off the stage, okay? We just kept getting encores, and finally we just said, hey, we got to get out of here. One of the guys ran to the rail. One of us guys threw up. And another guy, well, I think it was Walsh, just passed out. And so they had to go into the air-conditioned dressing room, and they hung out there until we could leave. But me and the roadies and a friend of mine from the cities were just in hog heaven. We just, let's just say we were a little bit buzzed, okay? They had some really good smoke down there. And I was under the stage when Jimi Hendrix walked by to do his set. And we were under the stage listening to him, and it was because it was really cool there when the sun was out. But at even night time, we found a good spot under the stage and camped out there, me and a couple of guys.
Were you there the whole three-day event?
Not that I recall. No, we were there just the one day. I mean, it got so crowded that they had to start, I think they had to helicopter some people in. But, I mean, there were so many groups and so many people playing, and it was nuts. It was like anarchy, you know? No rules.
I checked the internet today, and the estimated crowd was between 150,000 to 600,000, and
yeah,
they don't even know to this day exactly how many people were there.
Well, when we went on stage, they estimated the crowd to be 250,000.
Wow. That's
and
a
there
lot.
Was no way we could, I mean, it was human beings as far as the eye could see.
Wow.
Out front of the stage. It was just really an experience.
Okay, so your album comes out in August 1970. Do you recall ever hearing a gypsy song on the radio for the first time?
Never.
Never?
Never.
Really?
Never. They fell down on it completely. Metro Media just fell down on it completely, and we started hearing from people back home that they'd hear it on the radio now and then, you know, because back then you had album-orientated FM radio, and we knew nothing about what was happening in St. Louis. It was breaking huge in St. Louis, and we knew nothing. They never informed us, ever, to this day. They'd never said anything about the sales in St. Louis.